Pod. Pod. Whereabouts are you in London?
Yeah, I'm in like Kentish Town, North London. Yeah.
You getting ready to like release the album and everything, obviously?
Yeah, starting to actually have to do a bit of proper work now, like, you know, promo and that. Yeah, it sort of caught up on me quite quickly. I think because we've like, I mean, fuck knows when we actually started making this album. I can't even really compute it anymore because the time has just been so warped by the pandemic. But I mean, basically, we've now, I think, been sat on this album finished more or less for nearly a year or something like that. Maybe not quite, but a long time. It's taken so long to actually for this one to make it and then release it. So yeah, it feels like a long time coming. But luckily, I'm still not at all bored of the record. I actually still listen to it all the time, and I'm like, I'm excited for it to come out. So that's good because I was quite worried that, you know, having finished it long ago, by the time it came out, I'd be like, bored of it now. But I think it's great. So yeah,
nice one. Yeah, I was enjoying I Don't Want to Go to Mars. I think it's early days, but one of the songs of the year, I'd say.
Oh, that's good. That's good to hear. Yeah, I think it will go down very well live as well. I'd love it. I wish it would get like, I hope it'll get sort of picked up for a few sort of syncs and stuff as well. I think it's quite, you know, with the fairly topical subject matter, I can see it getting put over at least a sort of BBC space documentary or something like that.
No, there seems to be like a lot of relevant films to that topic at the minute and stuff, so it's interesting.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
Yeah, if we take it right back then, Fear of Flying, same lineup as White Lies. Yeah, how did it all come about back in the day?
Basically, me and Harry, singer of White Lies, we met when I think we were about, I want to say like 14 or 15, something like that. And at the time, I'd already been playing bass, playing music with a couple of other friends. And we would just play like covers. We were playing like Rage Against the Machine covers. And, you know, not really gigging exactly. But I think we would sometimes be able to like play in like a church hall or something. Like, not that I'm at all religious, but that was like the only place you could, you know, they would have a few amps you could borrow or whatever, or have a drum kit. So Harry then joined that. We weren't really called anything, but Harry joined that band, started just doing covers with us for a bit. And then maybe like 6 months later, that kind of just stopped happening. And I had gone to primary school with Jack, our drummer, and my parents were and still are very good friends with his parents. And I just heard basically like, my dad just said one day, like, oh, you know, you know, Jack from your primary school, he got given a drum kit for Christmas or for his birthday or something. And I think at the time it was just like, it just felt like a no-brainer thing to do. Like, I think I probably texted Harry and was like, oh, do you know this guy, Jack, who's now at school with Harry? So they went to the same secondary school. Harry was like, oh yeah, I think I know him. Yeah. And I was like, well, he's got a drum kit, so maybe we should just start a band with him. And that's pretty much it. He was up for it, and he was like, yeah, my drum kit's in my bedroom. My parents don't mind if we like play in, you know, in the house. So we just started writing songs from scratch then, basically. I guess we were just kind of jamming, really. They were very weird songs at first. And we were actually called The Flow. That was our first band name when we got together. We were sort of like sub Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of thing. And then that, we were just, with that, we were still just playing like, you know, someone would have a house party and maybe you could set up some stuff and play. There was a venue in West Kensington called West 14. I don't know if it exists anymore. Weird, really weird kind of like nightclub, I guess, but they did a lot of sort of I guess like open mic nights and things like that, but it was like pay to play. So we had to, we, you know, we, it was a proper venue, so it was like oh, this is great. We actually get to play on a proper stage and stuff. But one of those places where, yeah, you have to, I think, you know, as a band, you have to put a deposit of like 50 quid down, and then you only get it back once you've got 30 people through the door or something like that. And to be honest, that was way more common back then. It wasn't just there. Even when we were Fear of Flying, there were a couple of places like that. So it was this endless struggle of, you know, trying to book a gig and then invite every single person you know, and just desperately try and encourage them to pay £6 on the door or whatever and come in. So we did that for a while. Then it's hard to think about the chronology. So then I went to school. I don't know if you've interviewed him. I know he's done another similar podcast, but I went to school with Fred McPherson, who's singer of Spectre and was in Ox Eagle, Lion Man and Les Incompetents before that. And so Fred was Okay, great. Yeah. So Fred was a year above me. So Fred was kind of like, in a way, I feel he was sort of 1 year ahead in everything, and also had managed to somewhat infiltrate the kind of London indie club scene a little bit, more than I would have at that age. And so I think we managed to kind of just piggyback a little bit on the sort of things they were doing. We, at some point, as we changed name to Fear of Flying, then we started getting a gig at like White Heat Club every now and again. Then I think through Fred met the girls, Nadia and Sarah, that ran Young and Lost Club. We just started gigging a bit more, basically. Like, I think you have to remember that back then, you sort of Thursday, Friday, Saturday night entertainment, like thing to do for so many people was go and watch indie music live. Like, you know, indie clubs weren't, it wasn't like, you know, paying for tickets long in advance to go and see a big band at Hammersmith. It was just like a night out, you know, that's what you did. And it doesn't really exist anymore. It really doesn't. Now it's like, yeah, you know, you book a ticket to a gig, and whatever, go to the O2 in your local town or whatever it is. But it's, indie music has fallen out of, you know, super mainstream culture. So that's not what teenagers do on a Friday night. They don't go to a random club night that happens every Friday night where there will always be five good indie bands playing. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. So back then what was so wonderful is it was really easy to just play all the time. Like, you didn't really have any issues getting gigs because there were so many of those clubs going on and club nights. So yeah, we just played and played and played and, you know, started getting support slots with Mystery Jets and the Maccabees, Jamie T. We met Laura Marling when she was very young, became sort of good friends with her, and all kinds of bands. And then, yeah, you know, and then as Fear of Flying, we managed to get some demo time with producer Stephen Street, who's a good friend's dad, released a couple of singles on 7-inch, but really, you know, people wouldn't really touch us with a barge pole. Like, you know, we did fine playing these kind of little gigs, supporting people. And, you know, we had a few fans, I guess, but really we couldn't get any like press to write about us, really, or radio play. I mean, Jack and I used to go and stand outside the Capitol building in Leicester Square and text into John Kennedy's radio show on XFM and be like, "Hey John, we're downstairs, we're in a band called Fear of Fly, we got a demo CD for you, you know, or we've got our new single on a burnt CDR, can we send it up and can you play it, you know?" And like, a couple of times he did. You know, John Kennedy's just always been amazing, and he is one of the true sort of bastions of young indie music, and continues to be, you know, to do so. We usually still go in and do a sort of album playback as White Lies every time we release an album. So that's kind of how it began. And then bearing in mind at this time, we were basically on a gap year after finishing school. It's Fear of Flying.
Yeah, I was going to say, how old were you, like 17, 18?
Yeah, I guess about 18 or something. Yeah. And then we went through all kinds of things, like, you know, even when we were in school, we used to get gigs we started getting a few gigs around the country, and they would often be on weeknights. And we basically would meet at Victoria Coach Station after school, get on a coach and go to like National Express coach and go to like Exeter or whatever with all our gear, play a show, and then get the overnight coach back to London and go to school the next day. It was pretty hardcore, really. And so, or sometimes we, one of our parents might, you know, just give us a lift or take us to Northampton or something like that. Like, but it wasn't really happening for us. But by the end of this first gap year, we all technically had university places, but we were all pretty uninterested in going. And so we took the fairly risky move of just saying, all right, let's just try one more gap year, which is pretty unconventional. And we were like, let's just try one more year. And it was during that year that a lot of things kind of like unraveled. We ended up firing we had two managers who were partners. One of them was Jamie O'Bourne, who's gone on to, you know, start Dirty Hit and manage the 1975 and Wolf Alice and all that. You know, he's been massively successful. He parted ways with the other guy, Alex, kind of without much warning. I think they had some kind of argument, and he sort of left us with Alex. He never was like, please come with me. He just was like, we're not working together anymore, so you need to think about what you want to do. Whereas Alex was like, nothing's changed, we're all good, let's keep going. And that kind of attitude, we were just like, oh, that feels like he wants us more. I don't know, but he was, to be honest, incapable of managing. And we fired him, which was a very difficult thing to do, like the day before we meant to go on a little tour with the Maccabees. And he went to our rehearsal lockup and like stole a bunch of our gear to go and sell on Denmark Street. So we had to do this. We had to do this weird tour with the Maccabees where they were so gracious and kind to us. They let us use their backline, and they even let, I think, Jack and I stay on their tour bus one night. But it was a bit like, okay, this is now so DIY. We don't have anyone looking after us. And we're just sort of, we were printing our own t-shirts in Harry's mum's art studio. And it was just so DIY. And it was at the very end of that year that I don't know what our attitude was. It was still like, we weren't giving up, but we didn't have any faith that anything was about to like kick off. And we also weren't particularly, still not fussed about going to university. But anyway, Harry and I met up one day in his house, his parents' house. And we just decided to write a song on a keyboard because we never done that before. We'd always just jammed. And his parents' keyboard had like three sounds, like piano, some strings and an organ. And we were like, oh, let's write a song with the organ. God knows why. And we just wrote our song Unfinished Business really very quickly, actually. We were like, well, that's good. That sounds good. Okay, we'll book one day in the rehearsal room and we'll play it with Jack. So we did that. And then we were like, oh, this is quite good. We should really try and get a demo of it. Let's sort of beg Stephen Street for one last afternoon in his studio. And he wasn't available, but his engineer wasn't, and let us come in and do that demo. And then basically, this was MySpace days. So I met with Jack and I said, look, I think this song is good. I don't think we should just put it out as Fear of Flying, because I feel like, I don't know, we're not going to keep playing all that old material anyway. And also, we were quite calculating about it. We were like, we know how the music industry works. If we put this out as a new, under a new name with no photo and stuff like that, people will think it is an entirely new band and they'll get excited about it. Sure enough, that's exactly what happened. We just did a MySpace with that song and a little picture of a polar bear as the photo, and just came up with White Lies. It's like, yeah, that'll do. Good name, fine. And basically, it's just like, until the pandemic, it just basically hasn't stopped since then. And I'm not really even exaggerating. Like, the day we put that song on MySpace and I sent it around to a couple of people, it just spread. And we were immediately having like A&Rs in our MySpace inbox, and managers and lawyers and all these people suddenly going, who are you? You know what? I love this song. Like, what else have you got? What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And we were just very lucky in that the next song we demoed and recorded and put up was a demo of Death. And so, and that was maybe like a month later or like 3 weeks later. So we just suddenly were this kind of unknown band that had, though I say it myself, two really, really strong songs as like our first songs on MySpace. And understandably, I think people were getting quite excited. And then, yeah, it just snowballed. Like, you know, we just started meeting people, got our managers who we're with now, and started talking to labels, did more demos. And soon enough, we were recording an album, basically.
Yeah, like you said, I read there was a bit of a build up to that first gig. Like, what were those first few gigs like as White Lies?
Well, we actually did some secret warm-up gigs because we were so sort of... We knew that the first White Lies gig would be full of, you know, record industry types, and we were sort of bricking it. So our manager was like, well, I can just book you two or three shows. We'll use a different band name so no A&Rs spot it and come and try and see you early. And it would just give you a bit of, you know, dress rehearsal. So we did three gigs under the name Beethoven, spelled very, very incorrectly. I can't remember. We played Cardiff, Leeds, and Brighton. I think that's right. God, that'd be good memory if that is right. Anyway, just I think they were all actually like tiny Club Enemy gigs on like a Wednesday evening or something. Hardly anyone there. But it was great that we did it. So good to just run through the set like that in an empty room and get feedback. And I think it was probably at one of those gigs where manager said, or we decided like, oh, I think we should all wear like black shirts or something. You know, I think because mainly at the time it was like we had such crap fashion sense anyway. We're like, That's just an easy way of managing what we look like. If we just wear black, it's like it's easy. Don't have to think much. And then, yeah, we rehearsed for ages as well. We were rehearsing this little tiny room in Park Royal in a sort of trading estate. And we'd rehearse with like the lights off and stuff so we could sort of play without even looking. Bearing in mind, it's like six songs, you know, we only had six songs. So we really put ourselves through it because we, even though we were young, because we'd had this experience as Fear of Flying, like we did know how these things kind of go. And like, we knew that if we really screwed up the first gig badly, it wouldn't be good. And that first gig at Hoxton Bar and Grill just turned out to be amazing. A total blur. And again, it was like, it was like 25 minutes long. That's probably all we could play. So, but God, we were scared. But we were very excited too. And it really did go off, you know, without a hitch. It was like, we played really well. I do remember I think the Enemy came to review it and they said something like, if a bomb had gone off in this venue tonight, half of London's music industry would have disappeared or something like that. It was packed with all kinds of people. I remember... He used to be our lawyer, this guy, Ben Mawson, has now become one of my close friends. And he's gone on to manage Lana Del Rey and Dua Lipa and stuff. And I remember seeing him afterwards and he was a music lawyer. And he was just like, honestly, you have no idea. Like some of these people here, like these kind of people don't come to gigs. These are like the sort of head CEOs of labels and stuff, and like they never go to gigs, but he's like, it's weird to see these kind of people that, like, you know, just anyway, the glory days. So yeah, that's kind of how it kicked off, basically. That was the start, and then we just felt like we never stopped.
So what happened in terms of labels, and was there a bit of a bidding war kind of thing?
Do you know what, it wasn't really like that. It was, of course, there were different labels that were very keen. But it wasn't, you heard, there were lots of like rumors back then of the bands that's, you know, that signed crazy record deals. Like you always heard that band, apparently that band, remember Boy Kill Boy, apparently they signed like £1 million record deal or something, or like £750,000 record deal, something crazy. There were others too, I think everyone was just like looking for the next Killers or that kind of thing. And so anyone sort of like synth indie, even more so than us, we're getting signed for crazy money. didn't the Twang, I think the Twang got signed for an outrageous figure. Anyway, I'm not saying we didn't get a good record deal, but no, it wasn't like that. And I think from early on, we were very much like, we were really conscious of, we just wanted to work with like good people. Because we'd had the experience of Fear of Flying. We'd met A&R people before as Fear of Flying, and they'd always been a bit like, oh yeah, cool, let me know when you've recorded something else or whatever, like, you know, a little bit aloof. So it became apparent quite quickly that we would probably try and work with Fiction Records. We really liked Jim Chancellor, who was the head, still is the head, thought it was cool that his brother was in Tool. Yeah, I don't know. It actually really felt quite organic. There wasn't really any stress around that, like deciding or any, as far as we understand, any kind of, you know, hard negotiation. It was like they made us a really decent offer and seemed very supportive of letting us record it in the kind of more or less where we wanted to. They were really in favor of us, you know, continuing to work with Ed Buller, who we'd already done some demos with. And, yeah, and so we signed up with them and found ourselves in Belgium in a recording studio with Ed and our friend Max Dingle engineering, co-producing really, pretty soon after, as much as I remember. And we were, you know, we were having to kind of cobble songs together a little bit in the studio. Like To Lose My Life, the song was a kind of, we had the chorus and there were a bunch of songs that we were basically figuring out in the studio, which was kind of risky, to be honest with you. But hey, I guess the label were very, I get it. The label were like, you know, you have a buzz about you and, you know, we need to kind of strike while the iron's hot and get an album out before too long. So we made it work. And luckily, you know, one of Ed Buller's main strengths is his song, is, you know, basically a knowledge of songwriting and arrangement. So he was the perfect person to help us in the studio finish songs that were unfinished. Another producer I just don't think would have been able to do that. So we're, yeah, and that's one of the reasons why we continue to work with him to this day. He just really understands the band, for one.
Before you release the album, like you say, you've got demos like Unfinished Business, and I'm right in thinking that you released that under Jack's like independent label.
We did. I was just talking then, I remember, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, that did happen. I think, though, what actually happened is when we signed to Fiction, we said to them, not that it took much negotiation, but we were just like, but we'd really like, because we'll only have a chance once to do like a 7-inch limited edition sort of 7-inch single on a, you know, on a small label kind of thing. And Jack and Will Street, who's Stephen Street's son, and our friend Max at the time were running this, the Chess Club label and the club nights. And, you know, it just felt like we've got to do it. Like, we've got to do this one thing. It's got to start with friends and keep it in the family close to home. And so, yeah, that's exactly what we did. Fiction were like, yeah. Fiction were like, I think maybe they were like, absolutely, you know, we just licensed the demo to Chess Club for nothing. And we have a little Fiction thing on the back somewhere, maybe, but maybe not even. They just said, yeah, go for it. Just do it on Chess Club. So yeah, I think there were 1,000 of those, maybe 500, but I think we probably printed 1,000. Yeah. I remember as well that single, or even, no, it was the demo actually, was voted the song of the year in Music Week magazine. I seem to remember beating Single Ladies by Beyonce. I think it was Single Ladies, or was it? Yeah, I think it was. I think it was the same year. I have to check that. But it was so funny. I remember just getting sent the screenshot, the scan of Music Week, and it was like the top 20 songs of the year, 2008 must have been. And yeah, White Lies, Unfinished Business, brackets, demo, was the number one song of the year, which is just madness. Very funny. Yeah, yeah. So we put that single out with a B-side, and then we re-recorded Unfinished Business in the studio.
Did you ever release Death as a demo, or not really? Was that just a MySpace thing?
It was a MySpace thing, yeah. But, you know, back then, people were able to sort of rip stuff off MySpace and whatever. So I'm sure the demo's floating around somewhere, and it's not like radically different to, I wonder if I bet it's on YouTube. It's funny. I haven't listened to it in so long. It'd be like 15 years or something. It'd be funny to listen to it again. But I don't remember it being very different, but we did the demo with Max Dingle. And then when Ed Buller heard it, basically the first day we worked with Ed Buller was to do, this is all very confusing. First day we worked with Ed Buller was to record what would actually be the B-side to the Unfinished Business single, which was a song called You Still Love Him. And I remember we were in the studio doing that, and all he'd heard was Unfinished Business, and he loved it. And he was like, have you got anything else? And I was like, we've got one more song. This one called Death, we recorded it with a friend, Max. And he was like, let me hear it then. And we played it to him. And he was just like, it sounds really arrogant, but he was just like, this is like the best song I've heard in so long. Like, this is unbelievable. I can't believe that you've just played me this kind of thing. And he was like, I'd really like to do a mix of it for you. Like, do you think Max would let me? You know, I just think it could be a bit more cinematic in the mix. And if you're going to be playing this to labels and whatnot, you know, I think you should do that. So Ed then did a mix of it basically. And it was, I remember when he sent it through, and it was the first time I feel like I'd heard a piece of our music sound like a finished record, really sound like a finished record. And it was very overwhelming, actually. And I think that was the time when I was like, you know, this really might go somewhere, actually. Like, this sounds really good. And I remember playing it to my younger brother, and him for the first time ever being like, wow, like, that's your band. Like, that's insane, you know? I think Death didn't get released. I don't think it got released. No, maybe it did get released as a single. You're right, actually. Well, no, sorry. I know it got released as a single, but it didn't get released as a limited 7-inch. It was, there was a 7-inch of it, which was like pale blue background and three red towers, I think, graphic towers. Or maybe it was an E. Oh, man, I don't know. I do remember at some point, this was all with Fiction, and I know at some point that Fiction had the idea of releasing something they wanted to call like Summer of Death EP in the summer, I guess when we were doing our first festivals. I don't know what other songs would have been on that. I wonder if it's on my iTunes. I'm going to just have a quick look. I'm so bad at keeping like anything. No, I don't have it. Anything to do with us. It's actually really bad. I realized the other day, I was like, I don't even have a copy of our first record on vinyl in my home, either the original vinyl or the reissue, which is a little bit worrying, to be honest. I think what happens is I get given a couple of copies and then I just give them away to people that I think, you know, ought to have them. Like, I'm the one that's like, Ed Buller will call up or producers will call up and be like, oh man, I never got a copy of the vinyl. And I'm just like, oh, okay, I have just had mine. It's kind of bad. I've ended up with like nothing from White Lies in terms of like mementos. But I think my parents have basically collected a lot of stuff. So that's good. I will someday in the very, very distant future inherit my own back catalogue.
Just going back to, you know, that initial period in 2008. And first time I saw you was on Jules Holland. Vividly remember seeing you perform Death on that. I mean, that's quite early on for you guys. Was that quite a big deal at the time?
Yeah. So actually, we had to come back from the recording studio in Belgium to do that, Jules Holland. I think we'd been in the recording studio for like a week, and then we got offered Jules Holland while we were there, or maybe just before we left. And so it was a bit like, oh wow, like that's amazing. A little bit annoying that we have to like come back to London for a night and then go back to Belgium and sort of interrupt the album, but whatever, you know, obviously we're going to do it. I'm pretty, that is the only time we've been on Jules Holland. Yeah. sadly. It's kind of weird. Oh, I mean, you know, whatever. I think it's that thing where Jules Holland's had the same music booker for like for the 50 years or whatever. And I guess, you know, just we fell out of favor for whatever reason. But that was such a massive deal because we all watched it, you know, religiously. And so did our parents. And so I think that was probably one of the, even though we'd signed a record deal and stuff, that was probably one of the first things for our parents where they were like, okay, like this is real. This is actually happening. You know, my son is on Jules Holland. And man, we were so nervous. Cause I tell you what, it was the first series and possibly even the first or second episode of that series where they started recording it live. It never been live before. It was always that you went in on a whenever Tuesday and pre-recorded it. You recorded it as live, you know, but if you really screwed up, you could do another take. But they tried to do it as live. So it wasn't like you were there all day doing multiple takes. But anyway, the fact is it wasn't live. So you know, you didn't feel too bad. And when we were there, you had to record two songs that would go out on the long Friday show, and that wasn't live. So you did that first. Everyone did that first, pre-record. And then when it got to whatever, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, you'd set up again and you'd do this quick run-through where they'd be like, this is the order and this is what Jules is going to say. And as soon as he says your name, you start playing and, you know, we're live. So I do remember that playing, I think it was Unfinished Business was the song that we actually were asked to play live on the shorter Tuesday show. I remember absolutely bricking it. It was like, it was one of those things where when we finished the song, like the sigh of relief was just like, oh my God, I can't believe we got through. Like we didn't screw it up. We got through it. There were no mistakes. And it was just euphoric relief. And then we went back to Belgium.
What other bands were playing that night? Cause it must be, like you say, like intimidating for that kind of dynamic.
Yeah. The only other ones I remember was Jimmy Cliff. He was basically just singing Many Rivers to Cross. He was one of those guests where they sort of do a long interview with him and then he'll just do one song with the piano kind of thing. It wasn't like he was there promoting a new record or anything. Martha Wainwright was there, I believe, playing a song. And do you know what? I don't remember any of the other ones. Those are the only two I remember. Be interesting to look others up. I don't remember it being like, it wasn't, I didn't feel it was sort of star-studded. Like, you know, I think at that age we were kind of like hoping it would be, I don't know, like some, you know, some massive bands or something that we really loved. It wasn't that. But anyway, it was an amazing experience. And I always loved doing, we've done a bunch of TV show stuff, more in America since. We've done like Letterman a couple of times, Leno, some of the other ones as well. I don't know, it's good fun. Like, you know, we're like kids of the 90s, grew up watching TV, watching like MTV and watching those kind of shows. So it was like that. Whenever we do those, still feels like a really big deal, even though, of course, you know, the internet is such a bigger thing these days, really, than all that. But being on TV, knowing we're going to be on like American TV or whatever, is still, to me, it's like a massive kick. Yeah.
No, definitely. Like some of the best live performances of like the Strokes or whatever are from like Letterman and stuff.
Yeah. And there's a great, I know there's a great Radiohead, the Bends on Jules Holland and there's so many. Yeah, I know exactly. Like those just classic sort of performances. Is doing Maps on, I can't remember what it is actually, American, I think. But anyway, yeah.
Kind of like captures songs at the peak, doesn't it? I think that's the thing about it.
Yeah, it does. It does. Because you're usually doing them when the song's just been released. So you're sort of still buzzing about the song itself. But we haven't done one in ages. Occasionally we get asked on some sort of like something in Poland or Germany, but it'd be good. I hope maybe on this record we'll be asked to do a bit more of that kind of thing.
recording of that first album, like you mentioned, working with Stephen Street and then Ed Buller, who'd worked with the likes of Suede and Pulp. Like, what was there any like noticeable differences between those two in terms of the way they worked?
Oh yeah, completely. I mean, Stephen is like Stephen, I think, made his name being kind of like, let's just get the song down in the most pure kind of form, not too much studio trickery. Just get a great performance and bring the best out in the band, kind of thing. And he's, you know, become a legendary producer for that attitude. Whereas Ed is much more, he'll really get stuck into not just the sounds, but the instruments. And he, you know, Ed's the kind of producer that will say, that guitar isn't right for that part, let's go find another guitar. Or you know, and even before that, I don't think the song's in the right key, and what if you swap that chord for that chord. And you know, he really, really gets involved in the arrangement in a very old school producer kind of way, which I love. I mean, I've learned more from Ed than anyone else in my whole musical life, and I continue to learn from him. He's just full of practical wisdom that you can just apply immediately to your music. He's mad. I mean, Ed's, and he'd be the first to admit, he's absolutely bonkers. and you know, he's quite like me, really. He's very emotional and quite very sensitive, and so sort of prone to kind of large flourishes of emotion depending on what's going on. But he's become, you know, I see him every week still. We go for a walk together. He lives in North London too. And he's a great friend, and I think we'll just always work with him. And he'll always be happy to work with us. Not always as like full producer role. On Five, our previous record, we went out. He was actually living in America then for a bit. We went out and just did 2 weeks of sort of pre-production with him to get the songs properly in shape. And then we recorded them with someone else. On this one, on this forthcoming record, we worked on four or five songs, I think, with him after we'd already recorded the first half of the album. We basically sort of worked on the second half of the album with him, and then he came in and recorded them with us. So he's just a part of the family, really, and we just involve him at any point we feel will be really beneficial. And there's always a moment when it's like, yeah, we need to get Ed in now and work on this. Yeah.
And I saw at one point you were on the Enemy New Noise tour. How big an impact does that have? Or had you already kind of established your reputation at that point?
No, those were a big deal, I think. I mean, obviously only in the UK. No, they were important. And that was our first taste of like, getting back into what felt like a bit of a scene. There had been that when we were Fear of Flying with sort of the smaller bands, really, you know, really small indie bands. And then being on a tour with like Crystal Castles and I forget, because we did two of them. We did the New Noise one and the other one. I think the New Noise one was, yeah, it was Crystal Castles and then this band called Team Water Polo. And who would have been head? Maybe it was Friendly Fires. Again, we've definitely toured a lot with Friendly Fires back in the day. I think it was them. Anyway, but it was good. You know, it was good fun. I mean, there were small. There were the New Noise tour was like small indie venues around the UK. But I have to say, at that time, the best thing that ever happened to us, the best thing that we did, is just we were immediately playing in Europe, like just as much as we were playing in the UK. We'd go out there in a splitter van, you know, we'd drive from London to Germany in one straight drive, basically, and do these little mini tours, hemorrhaging money, I'm sure. That was the time when the label would give you a bit of money to go and do that. And not only that, but we had amazing people working for us in like the various, because Fiction's part of Universal. So we had the various teams in the other territories, especially in the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, and Germany. You know, people who unfortunately don't work, well, obviously we're not signed to Universal anymore, but they actually stopped working for Universal even before we were no longer with them. But they had such a huge influence over the first two albums of our career. and worked so hard. I feel like maybe I'm mad, but I just feel like people worked so much harder then and just really hustled. Like we would go to the Netherlands, and maybe it was just because we were a very new band, but we would be in the Netherlands doing like interviews all day long with like Elle magazine and all kind and new, you know, tons of newspapers. And like we would do promo all day long, like all day long, and driving in between radio stations and TV appearances. And we were so busy. And I think that's because, again, like indie music, rock music was still the mainstream. And so that's what was getting all the love. And now I'm sure, you know, the pop acts now, I'm sure they have that kind of schedule. But you know, bands just don't anymore because we've been moved slightly to the peripheries of what is on, you know, of what is mainstream, thought of as mainstream music. Yeah, so we were so busy and doing all kinds of cool little tours and little festivals and stuff that first year. I think when getting to America, we went out to America early on to do that CMJ festival. I don't even know if that happens anymore. Maybe it does, which is, you know, a bit like, and South by Southwest in Texas. We did all those kind of things. It's just amazing, like an absolutely amazing couple of years, being 19 years old. And I remember, you know, being in New York for the first time in my life, and we had a friend who was a few years older, and she ran a radio show, Elham, who's still just a very close friend, lovely person. And she was having to like sneak us into clubs and bars and stuff because she knew the bouncers, but we were, you know, way underage. It was just so exciting. Being in LA, being in Iceland, playing Airwaves Festival at like 19 years old, it was just wild. And we were like, it sounds glamorous, and it is glamorous in terms of the places we were going. But I might add that we were doing all of this, you know, staying in like the worst hotel, like motels and stuff. It was, you know, we were roughing it, driving around in sort of shitty vans and stuff. Like I remember the first time we ever went to New York, we stayed in this hotel. I think it was called the Union Square Hotel. No surprises, near Union Square. And it was very sort of guest house paradiso, like so sort of old school New York. And the sort of like really tall, thin building with like 15 flights of stairs, no elevator. And sure enough, we were all on like the 13th floor or something. So like heaving suitcases up this tiny, like narrow staircase. And then there had only been one room left for our manager, and it was in like the basement. And so he was literally in the basement right next to the sort of janitor's closet kind of thing. I remember him being quite upset about that. And it was scorching hot as well. There was no air conditioning. It was just like a fan. And it was like, it's got to be like 40, it was like 40 degrees in New York. I don't know, just amazing experiences back then. And almost a little bit sad that, like, because it all happened so quickly and we were rushing around so much, you know, I have all the memories, but I don't feel like I was able to kind of savor it perhaps as much as I would now. And actually as much as I do now when I'm on tour, like I go, you know, I go and explore during the day, and I really like stop to appreciate, oh, I'm back in Rome. Like I'm going to go and see this again, or go back to this museum, and how great, you know, whereas back in the early days, it was just like, where next, you know, where have we got to go to next? Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month, you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. I guess that kind of mad experience must peak when the album goes in at number one. Like, what do you remember about that time?
Well, we were filming the video for Farewell to the Fairground in Siberia at the time, as you do. It was, it was like minus 20 or something. And we knew we were kind of in the running. We'd been kept up to date, like, we've basically been told, like, it's going to go top five. We're very confident that the album will be top five, probably top three. And they were just, and our manager's like, it's just, you know, you just never know. Something else might just kind of knock it out of the top position on the last day or whatever. But sure enough, we got a call. I remember it was like very, it wasn't the evening, but it was just, it was one of those, it was in January. Of course it was in January. And so, because you're so far north, it's just dark all the time, basically, in Russia there. And so I think it was like late afternoon. Yeah, we got a call. We got a call from our manager, James, and he, he just didn't beat around the bush. He was like, hello, you've got a number one album. And to be honest with you, I remember our attitude was just like, I think it was just sort of, it was kind of disbelief, but also a bit like, all right, well, not much else to do. Just crack on with the video, I guess. Like, you know, we had a little shot of vodka with all the crew, and everyone went congratulations and blah blah blah. And then we just cracked on. And I don't remember, to be honest with you. Like, of course, it is amazing, and we'll never have a number one album again, I'm sure. But it doesn't mean all that much. It's a great PR blurb. Like, it's the perfect thing to put on your press release, like, number one album, and people suddenly go, cool, I'll interview them, cool, I'll talk to them, they got number one album. I remember getting home and seeing a friend of mine who's much older, you know, he's now in his 60s, and he was like, wow, so what, like, are you a millionaire now or something? And I was like, no, that's not how it works. You don't get paid anything for having a number one album. I mean, sure, it means you've sold a few copies, but that just goes to recoup your record deal anyway. So no, I'm certainly not a millionaire, and I will never be a millionaire. but it's funny. Like, I guess it changed everything and also nothing. In some ways, like, the only annoying thing is obviously it's almost impossible to beat. Like, well, it is impossible to beat, but it's almost impossible to match as well. So there was just, it did put too much pressure, I'm sure, on the second record and every record since. Well, no, not every record since, but the second record for sure. And I think, we were never going to have two number one albums in a row. It would have been mad. I do have some regrets over that second album. I don't think we approached it in the right way. And I actually don't think our record label A&R'd us in the right way. I think in hindsight, they should have forced us to work. Not that it would have been too hard, but I think they should have basically forced us to work with Ed again. We didn't work with Ed on the second record. We kind of got it into our head that we'd just do it alone. Yeah, we just went a bit wild unnecessarily, basically.
What, in terms of production?
And just kind of like not caring enough about the songs as we should have. I don't know. I think we maybe just got a little bit big for our boots, thinking, oh, we know how to do this now. We know how to make an album. I mean, hey, our fans love that second album. At least a lot of them do. Some of them, it's their favourite album, but it's not ours. And I do think that we had Bigger Than Us on it. You know, that was the saving grace, like that, you know, which is still one of our, if not our most popular song. If we hadn't have had that, we would have been screwed. But I think if we'd had two more songs of Bigger Than Us quality on it, we would have done, we maybe would have, I don't know, like, our career would have moved up and onwards towards that kind of realm of the Kings of Leons and the Killers of the World. Possibly. But I have absolutely no regrets, because where we are now is actually, it's just really pretty ideal. We I know I'm skipping ahead here, but over the 13 years or whatever it's been, we've basically been able to just gradually grow our band and our fan base and our reach without any support from charts, radio, or that much media and press. Like, I can't remember the last time, you know, The Guardian wrote about us in the UK. I mean, I can't even remember the last time that any really big publication and when we get a little, there's that Twitter bot for like the BBC that's like now playing White Lies on BBC Two or Six Music or even sometimes Radio One, you know, and it's like, whoa, like, oh my God, they're playing us on the radio. Like, it's crazy. So the fact that we're kind of like in the best, our career is at the best it ever was in terms of actually like looking at the largest picture. We're selling more tickets on tours than we ever have. And, you know, record sales, of course, are not as good, but they're not as good for anyone. And the fact that we've been able to do that so sort of organically without any kind of, you know, none of us are celebrities in any way, shape or form. No one gets recognized on the street more than once a year. It's kind of amazing. I think if the second album had just, you know, really blown up again and another number one and gone to, you know, just be suddenly in like a proper arena band or something like that, I don't know if we've been able to sustain it. I'm not convinced we would have been able to sustain it in the same way.
Have you always had like a consistent songwriting technique? Is it you and Harry?
I'd like to say that it's kind of evolved. Yes, it is me and Harry, but I'd like to say that it's kind of evolved. It certainly evolved for this record because we couldn't work together for the first 6 months of it. So I ended up writing a bunch of songs on my own and sort of, you know, submitting them and Harry did the same. But traditionally, yeah, it's a long drawn out process of me being in Harry's bedroom or spare bedroom or whatever. And just kind of chipping away. We are good in that we're very low pressure when it comes to the, like, when it comes to sort of the day-to-day of it. We just don't give ourselves a hard time. Once we think we've got a good idea and we're like, this could be a good song, that's when we're like, we really sort of whip ourselves. We're like, right, it's time to, like, you know, really work now. But we know that stressing out about coming up with an idea to start a song is pointless. They just write the first bits always just write themselves. So we basically just sit around and like, we usually listen to other people's music for about an hour, whatever, just anything, or just listen to the radio and go, oh, that's cool. Oh, look at that. That drum beat's interesting, or that, you know, and just nick stuff as everyone does and go, oh, let's try and write something a bit with that kind of groove or with that kind of feel or, well, I don't know, anything. But, you know, obviously, as with most any musician would say, probably 5 days out of six or 5 days out of seven, you leave with nothing, as they say. So it's just about showing up. I think ABBA have some kind of, it's that famous ABBA quote that's like, every day you wait in front of the cave and one day the dragon will come out or something like that. And it's, you know, it's basically like, just show up. You just got to show up. And then that's all you've got to do, really. Just show up, put the hours in and just don't worry about it. And one day you'll get the result you're looking for. But yeah, you know, it's been shaken up on this album. We had to write the first half separately. The second half, we've got together again with Ed Buller. But that's why this new one definitely will sound different. And the songwriting is different because on my own, I write very, very different songs to the songs Harry and I would write together, as to be expected, I guess. I think it's a really good thing. It was difficult. It was a very difficult process, quite tense a lot of the time, just because of a lot of things. But I had this feeling while we were doing it that, because it was such a struggle, I was like, I know this will be a really good album because we're struggling with it. And usually when you're struggling, you're putting more sort of passion into it. And it ends up being something quite unique. I remember, I'm absolutely name dropping here, but I do remember we went on tour with Kings of Leon in America. And it was when they just released the Only by the Night record, the one with Sex on Fire. So they just kind of become super mainstream. But we in the band had absolutely loved their third album because of the times. I still love it. I think it's a very just unique record that really, it doesn't even need to be thought of as a Kings of Leon record. It's just a great record. And I remember saying to Caleb in a bar in, we were in Nashville, I think. And we were in a bar having a few drinks. And it was near the end of the tour. And, you know, we hadn't been particularly fanboyish with them. They've been so hospitable and lovely to us. But anyway, I just said, like, listen, you know, I just got to say that, like, you know, me and the band, you know, your last record, Because of the Times, was like a really, you know, really important record for us. And we just absolutely loved it. We still love it. And it really, like, we were just, you know, very inspired by it. And he said, he basically said, well, we'll never ever make an album like that again. And I was like, why? And he was just like, well, we'd just been touring for like 3 years straight. We hated each other. We'd got me and one of, I think it's him and the drummer, maybe it was like, got into a massive fight in which I'd broken my arm. And my arm was in a sling, and I was basically told I couldn't play guitar for like 6 months or something. I was on all kinds of, like, you know, morphine for the pain. And he said, I wrote most of the songs in that condition with a broken wrist, like barely able to play the guitar on my own. I don't even know if it was at home or like he'd rented a little farm or something somewhere. I think it was in the middle of nowhere. And he was like, I was kind of out of my head, pretty bummed out, and just a bit of a mess. And he was like, but you know, it is obviously, everyone knows that out of those kind of extreme circumstances, that's when really interesting work happens. But he was true to his word, and they haven't written an album like that again. They went a very different direction after that. And I just remember that, and I was reminded of it when we were working on this one in the times of sort of arguments or tension between us or stress just getting it done, how long it was taking. And I remember him saying that and being like, you know, let's hope that's the same case for this.
Yeah, I read that you had some quite competitive ping pong matches on that tour. Was that the one?
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah, yeah, it was. Yeah, and it was one of my greatest moments, beating Caleb at ping pong in front of a large crowd as well. And, I'm not going to say I'm amazing at ping pong, but I'm pretty good. I'm so crap at sport, but, like, it's one of those things where for some reason I just have a little bit of a knack ping pong. And I think I was the first of our band and crew to like play. And I think, you know, I was sort of pushed forward, like, go on, Charles, like, don't screw this up for us. You know, like, everyone's watching, like, you're representing Team White Lies. And they were all of, like, you know, Kings of Leon's like Victoria's Secret model girlfriends sort of surrounding the table watching and all of it. So it was just like, cool, no pressure. And we played what can only be described as a ferocious and classic match. And I won. And I won very gracefully. And that was a good highlight of that tour.
Yeah, another big gig I saw you did. Did you play at Wembley Stadium with Coldplay at one point?
We did. That was a wild one. I think we did about six shows with Coldplay on that tour. And again, we're so lucky because we basically caught Coldplay in their finest hour. Like, I got to be honest with you, I really did not like Coldplay at all until that year. We got offered the shows, and it was one of those things where you'd tell your parents, oh, we've been offered some shows with Coldplay. And, you know, your parents would go like, oh, that dull lot. Like, oh, God, you know, how dull. It was like, well, no, it's good. They're like an arena, you know, they're a stadium level band. But then I remember, we were touring in America. We'd found out that we had been offered these shows. And we were touring in America, and we were in Seattle, and we were doing an in-store signing. Don't think we were performing. I think it was just an in-store signing in this little record shop. I wish my memory was good enough to just remember all these things, but what was it called? Seattle. There's a very famous record shop there. I think it's called, it might be called Black Cat, but no, that doesn't sound right. Anyway, whatever. And they had on the, it was a very cool record shop, like, you know, very cool, very indie. And they, on the rack of like recommended albums, you know, from the staff recommended albums, one of them was the Coldplay record, which I like to call Living La Vida Loca, Viva La Vida. And the blurb next to it from whoever in the staff was writing it, it basically said something like, it said something like, no, dot, dot, dot. Seriously, I know what you're thinking, but honestly, just try it, kind of thing. And that's basically like the opinion that I then went on to like evangelize to other people. I didn't buy it then, but I bought it later and listened to it, and I was like, wow, this is an amazing record. You know, I think it's the first one they basically did properly with Brian Eno, and I was like, wow, this is a really, really good album. And it does not sound like Coldplay, other than of course Chris's voice is always going to be like that. So we got to see them on that tour where they basically played 80% of that album. And it was a joy. The first show we did with them was in Helsinki, in a sort of outdoor park, a square of some kind. But we played with them there, and our dressing room was just in like a, I think it was like they basically just hired an office building that overlooked the park. It felt like an office building, just overlooked the park, right overlooked the stage. And we watched most of Coldplay's show actually from there that evening. It's the first one. And they have this song on that album called Lovers in Japan. It's a really lovely song. And on that song in the set, they did this huge explosion of confetti, like multicolored sort of pink and red confetti. I mean, huge explosion. And it all came right up and it all started floating in through the window that we were watching, or the windows that we were watching from. We're sort of catching Coldplay confetti, you know, from our dressing room. And it was just an amazing, amazing experience and moment. And then a few days later, it wasn't like a consistent tour. It was like we'd fly out to Helsinki, fly home, and then they wanted us to go do this one somewhere else in Europe, and we'd fly home. But I remember my ex-girlfriend had just called me up and broke up with me, basically, like, in between some of those shows. So I was quite sort of, you know, it was my first girlfriend, so I was sort of, you know, teenage heartbreak. And the next show we played with Coldplay was in Italy, I think in a place called, it was either in Ferrara or a place called Udine, anyway, in an outdoor stadium type thing. And I just remember like watching the whole show and then playing Fix You, and me just sort of really welling up, like very emotional. I mean, you know, one can't help but get a little bit emotional with that song on the best of days. But and then the Wembley show was the last one, and the lineup was insane. It was us opening, then Girls Aloud, then Jay-Z, then Coldplay.
Wow.
And it was two nights. We did two nights there. The same lineup, we did two nights. But the first night, or evening, I should say, we had been double booked for a little festival in Brighton. They really wanted us there in Brighton. Our tour manager was like, I've looked into it, and there is no possible way of getting off stage in Wembley and getting to Brighton by car in enough time to set up and do the show. However, if we were to take a helicopter, we could do it. And a helicopter costs £5,000 or something, and you're getting paid well enough for the show in Brighton that, you know, you can do it. And so in the most rock and roll moment of our entire career, we left Wembley Stadium and met a helicopter that had just landed in a public park across the road. And with all these like people walking, their dogs looking, going, oh, what the hell's going on here? Like, who's this? What celebrity's about to get in or out of this helicopter? And then they sort of see us, like, who the hell is that? Like a bunch of like scrawny little kids in black shirts, like, you know. And it was amazing. I mean, I've been in helicopters now twice in my life. Both were in White Lies situations, but the second time was just, it wasn't like a necessity. We were playing a show in Norway, sponsored by a helicopter company. And so like part of the thing was like, they give you a little helicopter ride around the fjords. It was beautiful. And it, but like after those two, I'm just like, I'm done. You know, the statistics of helicopters crashing and all that kind of thing is like to the point where two is absolutely enough for me. Like, I don't need to do it again. But yeah, man, you can get from like London to Brighton in like, it's something ridiculous, like 18 minutes or 20 minutes. Really? It's so fast.
Blimey.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, again, it's just one of those things where early on, you know, speaking to like, old school friends or family. So, oh, what are you up to this weekend? It's like, oh yeah, we're doing a gig in Wembley with Girls Aloud and Coldplay, and we've got to get a helicopter to Brighton. Just like, what the fuck? Like, it's just stupid. Our life is definitely, our career and our life is not like that at all anymore. It's much more sort of settled now.
But what was it like walking out of Wembley as well? Like, what was that kind of feeling like?
Pretty badass, yeah. I mean, big. But you know what? There is a sort of distortion of a sense of, you know, people that I guess because of how those larger venues are set out, it doesn't always look as big from the stage as it might, as it would look, of course, from an aerial view or from even from one of the seats at the back or something. So, but I mean, yeah, I'm not going to be around the bush. It's obviously, it's massive. And it was, and also you get these acoustics because of the way the tiered seating is. You do hear the crowd in a way that you wouldn't at like an outdoor festival. Because I think at that point that we did the Coldplay stuff, in fact, I'm sure, we'd already done some very big festivals, like as in played on the main stage in the afternoon at like Werchter in Belgium. It's gigantic. I think it's like 100,000 people. And a couple of others as well, you know, in Glastonbury and stuff like that. So it wasn't like it was the first time we'd done a big crowd. But yeah, I mean, it's always going to be a bit intimidating. But there's also a lot of distance from you in the front row. So it, in some ways, it's not as nerve-wracking. You don't feel like people are watching your every move in the same way as if you're in a tiny club somewhere.
Moving forward a little bit, I read at one point you changed record companies because, was it BMG wanted more radio-friendly music? Is that right?
No, I mean, it wasn't really that. It was, I don't know, I think I have sort of mixed feelings about it all. I think Big TV is probably our second best album, actually. Because I think the scenery of the music world was changing, and yeah, like I said before, indie and rock wasn't having such a good time on mainstream levels anymore. When we put out the first single of Big TV, and it didn't, you know, completely blow up in the same way as Death or Farewell to the Fairground had X number of years earlier, I think Fiction Records kind of just lost interest a bit. And they were then, I remember, you know, they were signing pop acts and stuff. They were starting to move towards sort of solo singer-songwriters pop, that kind of thing. And I'm not going to say they gave up, but it felt a little bit like they didn't give that record a fair shot that they really should have. And it all just got a bit complicated. People started leaving offices and I don't know. It came to a pretty natural finish, but I'm a bit gutted that album didn't quite get the love at the time from the people that could have pushed it, as I think it should have done. And, you know, our fans love it, so it doesn't stop our fans loving it. But anyway, yeah, and then we did... we just did one record. We did Friends with BMG. That was a more of a convenience thing, because we've always been signed to BMG Chrysalis for publishing, and they suddenly had this little label that was kind of working in tandem, and it was like, hey, we need a label to put the next record out, and I don't know, you know, deal got done. Didn't really work out either, because again, it's like everyone just leaves all the time. Like these, like people, you start working with people at a label, and then first of all, it's like, oh, the marketing person's actually quitting, and you're like, oh, they've only been working for us for a month, and it's like, yeah. And then they're like, oh, and actually, like the head of the label's also quitting, and you're like, great. Anyone else that we know is gonna stay? And it's just like, yeah, I don't know. Just it's not like it was when we first signed a record deal. Yeah, so we did that, and then we self-funded the album Five for the first time. We really wanted to make one, and we'd written the songs, and we basically paid for it ourselves, which in hindsight, I kind of wish we hadn't. Didn't really benefit us in any way, just meant we spent loads of money, of our own money on it. But anyway, but we knew we'd written a really, really good record, and it was basically done. So we were in a good position where we were just shopping it round, and Pias pricked their ears up and were like, yeah, we really like this. And we've been with them since, and we'll release this record with them. And I imagine we'll release the next one with them. They're really good, very supportive, but again, quite different. They're not, you know, early on in Fiction, it was like everyone was involved in every decision, and you were always talking to people at the label. And no, like now it's we're our own boss much more, really. I think that's kind of how it is for most artists, yeah.
And you're doing a lot more self-production now in terms of recording the albums.
I mean, yeah, this whole self-production thing is like, it's so silly. I always find it's crazy when bands, you know, write or sing it, or artists write, you know, co-produced by me, co-produced by the band. It's like, of course it's co-produced by you. Like, it's just what you do. Like, I don't know. It's an ego thing. We've co-produced all of our records because, you know, it's not like we sit there and if the producer at the time says, I like this sound and we don't like it, we're not going to go, cool, you're producing it, we'll go with the shit sound. Like, it's, you know, so I would just say we're more confident in the arrangement of things, you know, in how to arrange a song, you know. I'm not dissing any of our older songs. They're still really great, but I think we've learned how to make a song not just kind of, you know, linear and follow a same pattern. And we can, I mean, we've got, Harry and I have got into more sort of prog rock kind of stuff over the last few years anyway, so that's probably been an influence. But then again, I grew up listening to like the Mars Volta and stuff, so I don't know. But it does take time to build up the kind of vocabulary and musical vocabulary and the confidence to try things that aren't just like, okay, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. So that's where we've improved the most, I think. And we would never have been able to write a song like Time to Give from our last record, you know, when we were 19. Just no way. We wouldn't have understood it. We would have listened to it and probably liked it, but we were like, how's that a song? That's mad. Like, what's going on there? So, yeah, we just get better and a little bit more intelligent, I guess, is what it is, yeah.
Was there a high point of the early period kind of thing?
There was one, yeah, that we talk about this sometimes. There was one high point where, it's not the quickest answer, but basically we were scheduled to play this festival in Poland called Opener Festival, and our bus broke down somewhere on the outskirts of Germany, I think, on the way there, and it really broke down. We were stuck in a service station for like 6 hours, and we were like, oh man, you know, we're not going to make it to this festival. This sucks. But we were also a little bit like, it was going to be our first show in Poland, so we're a bit like, well, to be honest, you know, probably no one even knows us there anyway, and like, it's not the worst show in the world for this to have happened to. But anyway, the festival sent out a bunch of cars to drive like 3.5 hours to pick us up and drive us back. So we made it there in the nick of time. The other thing was we were starving, and the only thing we'd had to eat was like service station food. And I remember us being in the car on the way to this festival going like, we're like fantasizing, like, what would be the most amazing like food that we just, what would be so good if we just turned up and they had this kind of thing. And some of the guys were like, oh man, just really good pizza would be so good. And I was like, I could really go for some like Japanese, like sushi would be amazing or something. We're just joking. And we got to this festival, shown into our dressing room, and then our tour manager was like, right, you're on in an hour and a half, so you better go eat. And we go into this, the canteen, it's like, there's literally like an amazing like sushi station and then like a pizza station, pasta station. It was like really amazing. We're like, well, this day's turning out all right. And then we're standing at the side of the stage, an indoor tent stage, to go on and play. And the lights went down. And I remember being like physically like stunned and quite almost like terrified by the sound of the audience like cheering for us to, and I couldn't comprehend it. I was like, this must be something wrong here. Like, are we hearing another crowd for another band? Like, how can this be for us? Like, we've never been to Poland before. We have no idea if anyone even really knows us in Poland. And we walked up on stage and it was just this absolutely like gigantic packed tent, just packed, thousands of people in Poland and singing along to every single word of every song. And it was just such a slap in the face because just no one had been expecting it. And the fact that we'd had this really long day playing Frisbee in a service station car park, thinking we wouldn't even make the gig, it was just like the whole day just got flipped. And it was amazing. Really amazing.
We always try and get like maybe a funny story about the Gallagher brothers or maybe a big name from that time. But obviously you've given us some good stories already. But
I don't think we've actually ever really... We've never really come into contact with them, to be honest with you. I think we were once like offered some pretty green anoraks and it didn't work out. I can't remember what they wanted us to do. We were like, I can't be bothered. But that's about it with the Gallagher brothers. I'm trying to think of any stories. The only story I've got is, which I think is worth telling, is like bearing in mind, of course, that we toured with her a lot in the very early days. Quite recently, Florence of Florence and the Machine hid behind a pillar to avoid talking to us. And it gets better. We were playing a private, this is the only time we've ever played a private show. So don't think this is what we do often, but randomly we were playing a private show in the British Virgin Islands and we were on our way home and the whole party that we'd play was very mysterious. No one would tell us really like who else was playing or that kind of thing until the last minute we found out Florence was going to play on the third day of the party. It was only for like 80 people. Anyway, we're on our way home, or at least we're sat in this like beachside shack drinking Coronas, waiting for our flight. You just walk to the tiny airport, like across the tarmac. And I was like, oh, I bet we'll see Florence's lot turn up. And there was a, and sure enough, we saw this like, because you have to get a boat from there to the place, the island or whatever, where we were staying. And sure enough, this car shows up and we see Florence and her like PA, I guess, get out. And they're kind of just stood and someone's clearly saying to them, you know, the boat will be here in like 1 minute or whatever. And this bar was like, it's like the middle of nowhere. Like there's no one around. It's just me and the band and a couple of our crew sat and there's no one even else in this bar. It's like a tiki shack. And we're probably only about 20 meters away. And I just waved and was like, all right, Florence. And she did, you know, there's that like Homer Simpson meme where he like walks backwards into the bush. Like she literally did that and like hid behind a pillar. And do you know what? We had been joking before because we're so self-deprecating. We'd been like, she'll probably just like blank us anyway. Like she probably won't even bother, you know. And we were like joking about that. And she literally did that. And then she got on her boat and went. And then like half an hour later, the rest of her band, who were clearly on a, you know, not on a private jet or whatever she'd flown on, they show up and I wave and they're like, way, like they come and see us. And I'm like, oh my God, what the hell are you doing here? And all this kind of thing. And we just had a, you know, had a beer with them and had a chat. And me and the harp player, Tom, were texting each other. And I was like, you're going to like this resort when you get there. I mean, it's amazing. And I texted Tom a bit later. I was like, anyway, we were on our way. We were in transit in somewhere in America by that point. I was like, have a good time. I hope the party's good for you guys. They were a nice crowd for us. But yes, just thought I should say that, you know, Florence hid behind a pillar when we tried to say hello to her. And he was like, oh God, you know, oh, you know, I hope she's not in one of her moods then or something like that. And And then later on, we get this email from the kind of like liaison person who had been looking after us there, who was like, I have a message from Florence to White Lies that says, you know, she was absolutely mortified to discover that it was you waving at her. She had no idea that it was you. And I was just like, mate, we were like 15 meters away. Like, and it was the fact that her gut reaction was just hide. And, you know, she's so sorry and all this kind of thing. And I was just like, you know, and then actually Tom, the harp player, texted me later and was like, you know, I do actually think Florence feels quite bad about that. And I was like, well, the damage is done, and I'm definitely at some point going to be talking about that in an interview. So here we are right now. And, you know, these people got to learn their lessons. If, like, just be nice to everyone. And if it had been a table of fans, who cares? It's like five people in the middle of nowhere. Just go and say hello. Take a fucking photo. Like, don't hide behind a pillar. So there we go. That's my celeb story.
Excellent. Yeah, because didn't you? I read that you performed live with her at one point.
We did. She sung Unfinished Business with us for like five nights in a row at Brixton, and like all this, you know. So funny, but hey, you know, big time now, so very funny. Floating.